5 PM on October 27th, 2015, and this is the in-person interview of the new American School. The board and technical review panel appreciate that you have come today. We understand the application process requires time, effort, and intensive commitment, and we wish to thank you for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children there in Arizona. The purpose of this interview is for the applicant to demonstrate how well they understand and have thought through the plan presented in the written application. The interview panel will use the responses to the questions to evaluate the capacity of the applicant to successfully implement the plan to operate a high-quality charter school. We will start with introductions of our interview panel.
Hello, my name is Mary Berg. I work for Academic Support Services for the Lakeland Group in Arizona.
I'm Alan Mueller. I'm the Executive Director of New Schools for Georgia, which is a charter school incubator. For that, I ran the charter school office at the management of the schools for many years.
And again, I'm Tracy Esposito. I'm the Education Program Manager here at the board. I am the staff member who facilitated the review of the entire written application. Specialized right now in the new charter application process, and moving forward, we'll focus on charter renewals. And this is...
Oh, I'm Tammy Mandel. I'm also an Education Program Manager.
All right. We also have Whitney Choppa, Executive Director. She may decide to stop in and observe. And Erin Reddy is here from NACSA. She also may stop in to observe. She'll probably sneak behind you to those chairs over there. Next, I will go over the details of today's interview. And then following that, I'd like to give you an opportunity to introduce each one of you and what your area of expertise is, as well as your opening statement. The interview will last 90 minutes. I will review the procedures and ground rules for the interview process. You will be given 5 minutes for introductions and to make your opening statement, perhaps longer since there's more of you. Expect to spend 2 to 3 minutes on each response to your questions and allow time for follow-up questions that might be made by the interview panel. You can designate a primary respondent for each question or vary that as needed. Feel free to ask us for clarification on any questions. In order to give you the opportunity to respond to all of our questions, we will alert you to the amount of time that has passed during responses if needed. And we may ask you to move on and give you the opportunity to address any other issues in your closing statement. When 10 minutes remain in our interview period of 90 minutes, you will be asked to make a closing statement of no more than 5 minutes, and then I will conclude the interview with a description of the next steps and details about our final decision-making process. Do you have any questions about any of that? Okay, if you'll please go ahead and introduce yourselves, and then you can go right into your opening statement when you're ready after that.
Sure.
Good afternoon. My name is Albert Cignitos. I sit on the Governing Council of the New American Phoenix campus. I'm a retired educator, mostly in Southern Arizona. I've served in various capacities, including teacher, dean of students, assistant superintendent, CAO, and superintendent in large urban school districts to very rural tribal school districts. So I bring 30 plus years of experience in that arena.
Hi, my name is Amanda Patry. I'm a governing board member for the New America School in Phoenix location. I don't have nearly the experience as everybody else here on the board, but I've been really lucky in being able to bring innovation here to Phoenix. I traveled with Von Watterson to New York and researched the early college model at LaGuardia International High School, and then came back and was an integral part of the turnaround team over at Gateway Early College High School. So I've taught for 10 years and hoping to bring that expertise and passion for kids to the governing board here.
Good afternoon. My name is Yvonne Watterson. I'm principal of New America School Phoenix. I bring about 30 years experience as an educator. I started out in Northern Ireland. I taught English in Belfast. And since immigrating to the United States, late '80s, I've been a teacher, principal, assistant principal. Maybe most relevant to the application here is that I've been really involved in charter schools since their inception. I've turned around a couple of charter schools and been responsible for a startup as well. And as Amanda said, I think one of the things I'm really excited about is the opportunity to replicate New America School model here in Phoenix, using not just their expertise, but what we learned at LaGuardia all those years ago. Thank you.
My name is Dominic DeFelice. I'm the network superintendent. My main role with the American School of Phoenix is to provide some oversight responsibilities in the academic realm to ensure that the model is being followed. model. So fidelity to the model would be primarily my main responsibility. My qualifications include 42 years in education, started as a math teacher, worked my way up to vice principal, principal in two schools. I was superintendent in the Toronto District School Board, which is the largest school board in Canada. Has about 320,000 kids, 600 schools, and my main responsibility in the last 4 years there was to provide oversight over 300 schools in the west end of the city. I was hired by Jared Polis, the founder of New America School, about 10 years ago to be part of this organization.
Hi, my name is Greg Cook. I'm the Chief of Business Operations for the New America School Network. Like Dom, I was hired at the same time by Congressman Jared Polis to provide financial and operational oversight and development programs for the New America School Network. My professional experience is I was the Chief Operating Officer at the Denver Public Schools. As the Assistant Superintendent of Business and Finance and the Special Assistant to the Superintendent of the Kansas City Missouri School District when I was under the desegregation order. And prior to that, I'm retired Army Officer, retired in the late 80s.
Hello, I'm David Ryan. I am the Director of Development for the Network, and my role with New America School Phoenix will be to provide advice regarding communications and outreach, marketing, and public and private fundraising. I've already developed a website for New America School Phoenix and several materials for marketing and outreach. My professional background is 30 years in development, including a stint as the interim assistant vice president for development for Metropolitan State College of Denver. And over the last 5 years, I've helped the New America School Colorado in particular raise over $1 million a year in primarily public funds.
Thank you. And so I didn't say this before, but I'm the team lead, so it doesn't feel like it's fine. I'd like to thank you all for the hard work you've done today and for obviously for coming here. And we've all read your application and talked about it, and we have things we'd like to talk to you about. Certainly, I just wanted to let you know if you see us here and we're looking down or focused on things here, it's because we're looking at your work and looking at our notes. So not, please don't take it as rude. And we also may, just because we'll never have enough time to get to everything, we'll move along fairly quickly, but we may stop you and move on to something else. Again, my apologies in advance if that seems abrupt. But we want to make sure that we make most of our time together and cover all our questions. We're going to go ahead and start, I think.
So if you could please describe a typical day in the life of a student at your school with emphasis on features that would distinguish your school culture from other schools.
I think, first of all, I know that you have a copy of our schedule, and you'll see that our school day begins at 7:30 and goes all the way until the evening, and that's because of our target demographic. You know, we're targeting students who may face some obstacles that require them to have a flexible schedule. So we'll have students in the morning, and we might have students at night, students who work, maybe they have family obligations, that kind of thing. But really to speak to your question, I think one of the things that would distinguish our school from other schools is that we use the, we're committed to literacy across the curriculum and the SIOP model. And so if I'm a kid, I mean, I think that sometimes we don't, you know, we don't say to students, we really don't explain to them, you know, this is why you're learning this. So one of the things that every student would expect when they walk into the classroom would be to see the standard on the board and to understand that standard drives what they're going to learn for the day. And so one of the things in that hour-long period when a student comes in, they can expect to take out their journal, write down the standard, understand, you know, this is what I'm going to learn today, this is why I'm learning it, this is what I'm going to be assessed on. So I'm a kid, I show up, and maybe I'm in English first hour, I know what the standard is, I know what I'm going to say, make, do, or write to show my teacher, you know, how I'm progressing towards that standard. And then when I leave that classroom, there would be some way for the teacher to very quickly do either an informal formative assessment, which will then inform her or his instruction for the next day. So as a student, I'm always aware
of where I am in my progress. We have, as you've read in our mission statement, you know, while we don't know for sure, obviously, who's going to show up at our door, you know, we are anticipating ELL students. So you can expect to see those ELL strategies being used in every classroom, because they're not just good for ELL students, they're good for all students. One of the things that I've done, and I've been very fortunate to do, was kind of in response to your question, being able to visit a New America school in Colorado and to actually see what that looks like. You know, see kids sitting in classrooms where they are known, where they are valued, and where they're being held to high expectations. And so, I don't know if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I could. And if I could just drill down into 1 hour of the day, because you asked to describe what a kid would look like. When you walk into any classroom, whether it's mathematics, science, social studies, or whatever, the first 10 minutes is going to be devoted to sustained silent reading. We believe that literacy permeates the entire curriculum. Kids cannot learn math unless they can read, and they're not going to do well on the AZ Merit or whatever test the state is being used unless they are proficient readers. So the first 10 minutes, according to Krashen, you let the kid read whatever he wants to read. It's reading for pleasure. Then there's a 40-minute lesson, which is pretty well templated in terms of sheltered instruction observation protocol and what are the major components that you have in that 40-minute block, which will include checking for understanding, prior knowledge, the lesson itself, and as Yvonne mentioned, when you walk into a classroom, you're going to see an MPI, a model performance indicator, that indicates the content they're going to learn, what language is associated with that, and what kind of support they're going to get. In the last 10 minutes, you're going to find that the kids are going to be doing some purposeful reading. They're going to be doing reading related to the subject matter. It's mathematics, they might be reading a biography of Newton or whatever, but it's going to be related to that. And then throughout that 40-minute block is when the learning occurs, the teaching and learning occurs, and throughout that there will be considerable what we'll call formative assessment. No kid will leave the classroom unless he hands out an exit ticket that demonstrates that he or she has learned what was to be done during the day. That's like a typical 1 hour class.
So to follow up, just one question. So is there a difference in process when it comes to learning between the 10 minute pleasure reading and the 10 minute purposeful reading? Obviously the focus is different. Does the purposeful reading have anything else that is it guided in any way?
The first 10 minutes is you can read anything you want, and they'll start with a comic book. Sometimes they won't do anything. When you get to the purposeful reading, there is some intent there. So it'll be relevant to the lesson that they were going to do.
But no, but not interaction, not active instruction.
No, it is not.
Right.
And just to jump on that, I think that one of the things that I've noticed, certainly from dealing with this population and when we work together, what I learned very quickly is that so many of the students we served and anticipate serving, they don't come from print-rich environments. So they don't see their parents reading. You know, they don't see people reading for pleasure. They see people, and quite honestly, you know, reading bills. You know, what comes in the mail, junk mail, that kind of thing. But, you know, just I think it's good practice. Anytime you're teaching, you move from what kids know to what they don't know. So how can I hook you into reading in those first 10 minutes? And so I think that's the kind of thing that we would be seeing. But it's really important, I think, to emphasize, and I think all our students would know, that if you're not literate, you're not going to be successful. So how do you infuse literacy in all classrooms?
And Tracy, I don't know if we've got some more time on this, because I think...
We'll stop you if you just go at it.
Oh, okay. The other thing is, given our target population, we're not going to instruct them the way they would in a traditional classroom. So if you were to walk into a mathematics classroom, and Yvonne talked about the SIOP model, the Sheltered Instruction Observation Protocol, which is a nationally researched methodology, I think, let's say we're in a mathematics classroom. You've got a word wall over there. Inside those little sleeves, you're going to see key words for the particular lesson. You might see the word coefficient. You might see the word polynomial. You might see the word like, unlike, because today we're going to be collecting like and unlike terms in the polynomial expression, for example. So when the teacher says to the students, today we're going to do literal coefficients. All of a sudden, if you're an English language learner, you don't really know what that means. So language could interfere with the content delivery. But if the teacher grabs the word coefficient, now that the student sees the word associated with what is being spoken, and then they get into it. So what we're trying to do is something that would be atypical in a traditional school with English language learners in front of them. We're trying to shelter it, we're trying to scaffold the learning, we're trying to give them an opportunity. As Ms. Fitzsimmons mentioned, they said that the double the work research that came out of the Carnegie study indicated that for English language learners, it's twice as hard to learn in school as any other student, because not only are they learning mathematics, they're learning English at the same time. So that's just, like you asked, what's a kid going to look like or see during an hour? Probably that.
And I think one of the things I would stress to kids, because I know I used to do it, it's, you know, we're sort of together, we're creating a culture of evidence. Prove it. Show me what you know. Show me what you're learning. How can I see it? How do I know that you get this? So one of the ways in which we would do that would be, you know, a student would understand, here's what excellence looks like. And so you would see rubrics on the wall and actually explain, this is what a rubric is. You know, I've had experiences where kids will say things to me like, well, what are those six? We see the posters on the wall, but they've never actually been explicitly taught. So I would think it would be very important, and I would certainly require this as the principal, that in those opening lessons at the beginning of a school year, you know, you're explicitly teaching kids the norms of school-going people. And this is what it looks like when you do well. Let me show you what that is. So I think that we would spend a lot of time doing that too. And helping, as you mentioned, with scaffolding, you know, how do you help kids actually tackle expository text? You know, what graphic organizers are going to be the most relevant and the most useful? And it's not just about having, you know, the word walls up there, you know, for decoration so we can check a box and say they're there. It's, are they current and usable, and are we filling a kid's toolbox with these words and these meanings that they're going to need to go out into the world of work or college or whatever it is that they do?
To me, in a sense, you're starting, well, you're painting a picture certainly of a, let's say, from a cultural perspective, a culture that puts literacy and reading up front. So I would like to know, just in terms of, and you mentioned some visible artifacts, but
sure,
tell me some more about how that culture is established in your school and perpetuated. It could be for folks walking in the door, or communicating to parents, or however you maintain that as a sort of thing.
Well, before you can communicate it to parents, you have to get the teachers on board. So what we do on the model that we have that's already embedded into the application, there will be one Friday every month that's completely devoted to professional development of the staff. Mm-hmm. The kind of things that we've just talked about, the rationale for having SSR, silent reading, the rationale for having purposeful reading, the rationale for all the kinds of things are spoken about at those particular sessions. People are brought in to talk about them that have the expertise in that. So we get the buy-in from the teachers. Once we get the buy-in from the teachers, we soon get the buy-in from the students. So all of a sudden, a kid that walks in and says, I'm not going to read. You don't want to read? Don't read. But for the first 10 minutes, you have to be silent. Put your phone away. And in time, what we have found is that every kid is reading. Every kid is going from one classroom to the next classroom to find his reader, the book that he's going to read. They're Lexile appropriate, so we're not having books at a high level that the kid can't read. They're all appropriate. They're all tagged. They know which one to grab. They're going to grab the red To Kill a Mockingbird as opposed to the blue one because it's Lexile appropriate. And then once that information is shared with the students and the staff and the buy-in occurs, that's when you can communicate it with your parents. Kids walk into the school, they know what to expect. There's a word of the month, word of the week, so that you say, this is the word we're going to emphasize in all our classrooms in this particular week.
You mentioned getting the buy-in of your instructors. So tell me about the experience you've had so far, and it seems to me you need fairly unique individuals to be successful in this program, teachers. So in recruiting and hiring, have you, and obviously you select to some extent for folks who have strengths in these areas, but tell
right.
me.
Well,
your challenges.
I would say the greatest challenge is to find quality staff that are aligned with your mission and then buy into the kind of model that we have. And if I were to tell you that every single teacher in the organization follows this and loves to do this, I would be lying. there takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to inculcate the kind of culture that you want in the school visible in the classroom. And I think one of the big purposes of the principal as the instructional leader is to do those daily visits, those daily walkthroughs in every classroom to see if the what we've intended to be happening in the classroom is actually happening. Not only is the curriculum being taught, but is the methodology in place? Are the kids learning? And I think that that is something that is primarily the principal's responsibility.
Well, sorry if I'm putting words in your mouth, please, but if I said this incorrectly, but if you're, when you're recruiting and you're looking at new teachers, are you say that you're focused primarily on mission alignment and that, I mean, obviously there's some aptitude primarily mission alignment and the other is trained in, or?
We will not have a successful teacher in front of kids unless they believe in mission. They believe in working with these kids. These kids are very difficult to work with. And we find that many teachers, after a particular period of time, cannot cope. What you need to do is, when you're hiring the people, is talk to them about, this is what you're going to have in front of you. Are you able to cope with that? And if the answer is no, then you're going to make a wise decision better before than after that this is not a good fit for the school and with the student.
And one thing, I really want to stress this, because I have worked with Title I populations for pretty much most of my career. I'm first generation college myself. You know, I'm a working class girl from Northern Ireland. I went to school during the Troubles. And one of the things that I noticed as a student that stayed with me all these years is you can always tell when you have the teachers who have this close per kids, that kind of approach. And that's not what we're looking for. I think that there is, for me certainly, we're looking for teachers who are committed to empowering students, not enabling them. To empowering students to realize a vision of themselves that's way beyond their zip code and their neighborhood. And that starts with having very, very high expectations, but being able to articulate to kids, here's what excellence looks like, and here's how I'm going to support you to get there. How do we do that? I think that I would be irresponsible to hire a teacher if I wasn't able to observe that teacher teach. So part of our interview process, and I know that you can speak to this, is...
I'll just wash your face while you talk.
Yeah.
Okay. Part of that would be, well, no, but you know, I would say to teachers, look, we'd love to have you come in, and what we want you to do is bring a standard-based lesson plan and share with us, you know, as though we are your students, 15 minutes of that. If it's possible during the school year to have parents and students on the interview committee, then that's wonderful. Because at the end of the day, you know, we work for the students, we work for the parents. You know, they're paying us, and they entrust those kids to us every single day. And so, you know, they should be involved, I think, in that process. And so I think, and when I find this to be true, and I don't expect it to be any different this time, is that when you can tell even on the phone, when you say, now we need you to do a demonstration lesson that's standards-based. I mean, I'm actually embarrassed on behalf of the profession to share with you how many times a candidate will say, oh, no. And it's true, where they really don't want to come in and do the model lesson. Because what that does for me, I mean, just as formative assessment's good for kids, it's really good to inform your professional development. So if I've got a brand new teacher, like when I hired you, you know, I can tell pretty quickly, all right, here are some areas where this specific teacher's going to need some support. And then you differentiate your professional development. It's going to look different, and it's going to be targeted. A first-year teacher is going to need something different from a Teacher of America teacher. It's going to need something different from somebody who's been in the system for, you know, as long as I have. So all of those factors, I think, come into play at the recruitment of teachers. I think the mission alignment is critical. One of the questions I always ask is, please tell me how your personal philosophy of education aligns to the philosophy and the mission of the school. You know, tell me about that. Tell me about a time when you had to revisit your classroom management style. What did that look like? What did you do? How did you fix it? Those kinds of questions. And so the interview process, you know,
I'm having like PTSD about it right now. I'm sitting here like reliving it, exactly how you're saying it. Those are the exact questions I was asked.
Well, when we tell them, you know, that you know, we want to see evidence of your ability to incorporate those strategies that will enhance a student's literacy. We want to see you using the, you know, the PSYOP model. So it's not a surprise, it's not gotcha. It's here's who we are, and we want you to see who we are right from the moment you come into an interview. So does that, does that answer?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you a question. Yeah, just so this is clear, makes it clear for me, I know you said this in your petition, that please remind me as you go through, if you're going to be at the school, the post school, what your role will be at the school, or if you're going to be a board member.
Board member, correct.
Teacher in the school?
Yes.
Administrator in the school?
Principal, yeah.
Oversight consultant.
So you're out, but you're outside of the, okay, the day-to-day, also outside of the day-to-day, also outside of the day-to-day. Okay, just wanted to, thank you, that helps me.
I'm glad that you asked that, because you didn't remind me of something. I can't help, it's the Irish here, we just started and can't stop. But one of the things, too, that I learned is that, you know, because one of, I think it's Anthony Mahalan, who's done a lot of work on school culture, and one of the things that he talks about these 10 norms and the extent to which they exist in your school determine how healthy your culture is as a culture of learning. And one of them is the extent to which you're willing to take risks, but to reach out to the knowledge base. And so I think that, you know, when we bring our teachers in, these prospective teachers, and we can say to them, look, there's a school in Colorado, there's a school in New Mexico, you know, how can we get the kind of support that this brand new teacher is going to need? We can, you know, there are opportunities to partner them with the teachers in Colorado, teachers in New Mexico, you know, so to try to build in some mentoring for new teachers as well, because, I mean, I know this is not news to you, but we lose so many potentially great teachers during the first couple of years because they don't have the support. And so I think that the New America School really offers an opportunity to attract the best of the profession and to retain them.
I think I broke in the middle of your question before, so I don't know.
I think both of them have been sufficiently covered.
Can you talk a little bit about remediation in your school? Just tell me, given the target population, I know your pandemic's coming up, you know, but what do you expect, what are you preparing for?
Maybe, why don't I start in the
Okay, sure.
Unless you want to go.
No, you go, and then I'll go.
Okay.
no,
an Irish interrupting an Italian,
I know.
Can you imagine? So, in terms of remediation, we're very cognizant that in Arizona we've identified 4 subgroups that will require some potential remediation, and I know that some of these subgroups will intermingle, because they'll be in one of 2, if not all 4 different categories. Primarily, we have a Friday opportunity, because we run school from Monday to Thursday. The Friday is an opportunity for those students that have not been successful during the week to come and get remediation. Not that they can't get it during the day, but sometimes their schedule would not permit that. So Friday is an opportunity where they can come in. We would have teachers available for math and language arts so that they can catch up on that. So that's one particular opportunity. The second opportunity would be in the class, in the school itself, to start to identify those kids. And I'm going to use a, sort of like an RTI kind of approach, where you've identified a base of kids that, in spite of what's happening in the classroom, they are unsuccessful. They will require some additional support. How does that additional support come in? It comes in through the form of either peer tutoring, other individuals in the school that can support the students. It can come in the form of teacher intervention in terms of helping them. It can come in from before school, after school. We notice we have a 7:30 block where kids could come in and pick up some additional tutoring at that particular point in time. So there are opportunities available within the school day, Monday to Thursday. There's opportunities on Friday. There's clearly opportunities through some software. We've got I don't know what we're going to purchase in Arizona. We use E2020 in Colorado and New Mexico as additional support for students in terms of credit recovery. So there are a number of software available opportunities for students.
Can I just ask you a question? I'm sorry. See, now I'm going to interrupt the interrupter, so I apologize. have you found in those other schools that you found software-based credit to be helpful?
I'll tell you where they're effective. They're effective if you've got the right teacher in there to support the students while they're doing it. If you leave the students on their own, they're not going to be very successful. That's number one. So you need teacher support. But you also need them simply because of the potential clientele that we could have. We could have a young woman come into the school for the first quarter, pregnant, has to go on maternity leave, leaves in quarters two, and then comes back in quarter three. All of a sudden, how do you fill that gap that's missing in quarter two? Well, that's where that is an opportunity for us to catch the student up through some software development, E2020 Odyssey, where there are a number of software where you indicate, here are the standards, here are the goals that the student has missed, and here is a customized 5-6 week program that the student can catch up on by doing it 1 hour a day.
Thank you. Sorry for that.
I was just going to say, on top of what we know about the sort of the traditional RTI model, I think that we really have remediation embedded throughout the day. Several years ago, I had an opportunity to work with Margaret Heritage, and I hadn't been familiar with her work on formative assessment before, but it really changed the way I thought about assessment, and I realized, formative assessment is just really good teaching. And so she talks about the importance of being nimble and flexible in the classroom. So it's the formative assessment that occurs, you know, every minute, every hour, every week, at the end of the quarter, at the end of the semester, at the end of the year. But it's those moments in the classroom where you can really remediate. And so how do you, very quickly, I mean, you would see when you asked earlier about what a classroom looks like, I mean, teachers, they gotta be, you know, out of your seat and on your feet, always on the move, trying to see where those kids are who might potentially slip through the cracks. Maybe a very simple remediation would be, okay, so I see that, you know, these students right here are struggling with identifying the main idea and something, so I'm gonna pull them out and have some, you know, some small group instruction over here during the class. And so in addition to the more formalized remediation opportunities, and also opportunities for enrichment, you know, you have what you're doing during each lesson as well. And again, you know, we don't know, as you said, who's going to show up for sure. But I think in some of those moments, you start to identify students who can really achieve at high levels, but because they face up significant obstacles to a college education, you know, they've never really had an opportunity to push themselves a little bit further. So there might be ways that we can create systems and structures, partnering with community colleges, for example, to get them into a track that will support them. So it's really about targeting, and differentiating.
One of the things that we're trying this year for the first time in Colorado in our three schools is to introduce what we call a math lab. When I was a math teacher, we did that back in the olden days of the 70s, where you had manila envelopes, and each manila envelope had a particular concept that students that didn't understand it could go to that manila envelope and work on it. What we're doing now in Colorado, and I think it's going to be highly successful, is we're looking at students that are not coping well in the regular math classroom. So a student might be in a geometry classroom, isn't doing too well, the teacher identifies this is a student that could benefit from the math lab, they are sent to a math lab which is over and above the mathematics course that they would take. They fill the gaps that are there. And it's possible that if the student wasn't in this mathematics lab setting, they may not get the credit for the geometry. But because they're there, they get additional support, additional remediation tutoring, and they are successful in those skills that they have not learned in the regular classroom.
So in just when you were talking about the remediation, made a connection to development, let's say, or maybe talented and gifted. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. You mentioned about reaching out outside resources to develop some. I wasn't sure I was quite clear about that. So if you are in a situation where you might expect to remediate, or you might expect to have a child who's behind, you may not be behind in some ways, and you notice an opportunity to bring them above and beyond, right? So what, how do you see doing that? Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
you mentioned reaching out and sort of finding a track or finding something.
I think that those ideas came from, I think the first time that I visited LaGuardia, which was back in 2000,
2003. We went to the Borneo Middle College High School and the International High School there. So just to give a little bit of background, my issue at the time was that I walked into a school where I had I had a 50% dropout rate, nobody was passing the standards, and I had a 50% attendance rate, and I thought, what am I going to do? And so I'd been made aware of the middle college, early college model, and I went to LaGuardia. And what I found there was that when students, they may have faced these significant obstacles outside of school, whether, you know, no one at home spoke English, poverty, whatever. But what they found was when they created these tracks, and it might have looked a little bit random, but some of the students, they sort of got on this track where there were enough students that you could identify maybe a class, maybe a dual enrollment situation, and so there was a partnership with the community college there. And what they noticed was that these kids, the power of the site, which was you had high expectations, they were also on a college campus, a high school on a college campus, but it elevated students, and then they started to, you know, they wanted to do well and do better, and they could. And then they were outperforming, you know, college students as well, and these were kids for whom society typically has the lowest expectations. So between the high expectations, the culture of excellence that we were creating, and recognizing that they had ability that may not have been noticed before because of some of the labels and frankly some of the stigma that we applied to some kids, you know, they've been denied those opportunities. And so what we found then when we came back to Phoenix and replicated that, you know, we entered dual enrollment agreements, current enrollment agreements, then that affected the hiring. You know, if I was hiring a high school certified teacher, could I also hire someone who was community college certified? You know, so then, you know, I think that really for me the key was who's going to show up, and then you've got to just with a sense of urgency, you have to be flexible and responsive and quick, so that you can catch it and can do something quickly.
And to your point again, in terms of the identification and how one would deal with them, one of the things that we're able to do through our NWEA MAP testing is identify kids. There are reports that come out of NWEA once students take the fall score, fall test, and it's an adaptive test, and I don't know if you're very familiar with it, but they will identify where the kid is at, who to group the kid with. So they will identify his reading level, his math level, those standards that he is proficient in, those standards that needs a little bit of work, those standards that require a lot of work. And they will say, the following four students should be placed over here, working in a cooperative structure so that you can remediate them because they don't get it. These guys are working at a 240 RIT level where you've got to give them something extra because they're bored out of their mind in the classroom. So we have the ability through NWEA MAP testing to identify circles of kids that are working at approximately the same level where you can identify the kind of skills that they are lacking or have way beyond the rest to then provide differentiated learning.
But one would hope that is almost an affirmation, right? I mean, not hope, but you're going to have to move ahead of that, right? I'm saying that by the time you get the results, you should have already...
You know that through... Right. But the kind of formative assessments you do, the diagnostic testing that we do, and all that kind of stuff.
You know, sort of on that note, I mean, it's a little bit different, but this just occurred, maybe it's because you're sitting next to me, it just occurred to me, but one of the things that was really alarming to me when I first worked with this population, and you'll notice that one of our graduation requirements is community service and service learning, and I, you know what I'm going to say, but I will never forget the time we told the kids, you know, that they would do community service. And there, the connotation of community service was punishment, because they were used to community service, you know, as a punishment maybe for themselves or people in their families. And so just to be able to shift that paradigm, and you know, when you took those, I mean, I think you were the first one to have the old female Habitat for Humanity build, you know, those kinds of things are very empowering. And then really using the standards to drive the community service.
Well, and it just embeds, you know, realism in what those students are learning. And when students know, I need to know, you know, fractions and math in order to measure and go out and build something, then there's, I mean, there's motivation to learn it, because it's not that the students can't learn it. It's not that they don't want to learn it. They just want to know, why do I need it?
Right.
And if once they know why I need this to be successful, they have, they're, I mean, you can just like let them run with it. They're so excited to learn about it. So it's, I think.
And wouldn't you agree, honestly, it was through some of those opportunities that we were able to identify the kids who could stretch. You know, it was a powerful thing, and I actually hadn't even anticipated talking about it today, but that was really significant for us. How do you use the classroom, you know, the relationship between the classroom and the community? You know, what's in it for the community? You know, not just bringing the community in to, you know, to give a talk, but how can you actually go out and do meaningful work that will empower you as, you know, as a member of the community, as a worker, as a student?
And for me as a teacher, it was a real opportunity for me to see kids' interests. And once I knew what they were interested in, I could really help them guide some of their own learning and the learning in the classroom. Because when they had an interest in something, I just forgot my train of thought. I don't know where I wanted to go. I'll lose it before then.
But, you know, I think it was that whole, it was the rigor, relevance, relationships thing. And this was not just given lip service to that. I mean, we were able to implement this rigorous curriculum, but then through those opportunities, it became relevant to the students, and then they knew it was being delivered by a teacher, you know, because you know yourself, I mean, the relationship, the interpersonal relationship between a teacher and his or her kids is probably the most significant factor in terms of improving student achievement. And so when I have Amanda saying, okay, I'm picking them up at 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning to take them to go do this, and they showed up and they felt valued, and then it motivated them, you know, to go out and do more, and they brought that into the classroom, and then they were able to attack some of the trickier academic material, and then they were more willing to go to you to get the
I was going to say is, I can better identify some of their strengths and their weaknesses, and especially their strengths, and build from there. Because once some of those kids saw that they were really good at, you know, whatever it was, whether it was writing, whether it was building, whether it was, you know, whatever, then they were really able to let their guards down and say, look, this is what I like to do, and this is my skills need a little bit of help right here. And then they were motivated.
I want to shift just a little bit for a moment over to this side over here. And that's one of the things that a support organization can provide is expertise, track record in establishing the kinds of partnerships that might enable community service or collegiate colleges that might facilitate sort of that attracting kind of. So can you talk a little bit about the support organization's experience doing this in other schools in Denver or elsewhere in New Mexico?
Well, I'm going to combine that question with some fundraising talk as well. One of the things that we've been very fortunate in the last few years is that in Colorado we were able to secure a $2.5 million 21st Century Community Learning Centers grant. And as part of that grant, that grant focuses on after-school, out-of-school learning. And as self-interest and self-preservation, to keep that kind of a program going, you need to form partnerships that are willing to extend beyond the term of the grant. The service learning component at our schools that we require, I believe it's 6 hours per year, each year to graduate. The community learning centers have taken over the lead in promoting service learning, community service, and have been able to form a wide variety of partnerships to deliver experiential education. Like the Boy Scouts are providing ropes classes for our kids. Ronald McDonald House is providing service learning opportunities. We have several partners who are providing content for some out-of-school time classes such as the Botanic Gardens. Another key area that we found that we need to form partnerships with is social service agencies and agencies that that provide things like drug counseling to our kids, because we deal with high-risk population who a good percentage of our population manifest four or more risk factors. And without that kind of a network to assist the schools, really not going to reach all the kids. As a matter of fact, just on Friday, the Colorado Schools Counseling Intervention Health Professional staff all got together to discuss ways of broadening a web of support, which the theory is that you can't do everything in the schools, but you need to have outside partners to provide these kinds of services. And
So let me just say first, I'm sorry, but so your answer to this may just be no, I don't know, but every state is different, even though there are similarities. We're talking about federal grants here, but also local, all our local things. So to your extent, you've looked into it, what for the Arizona school, strategically, where would you go? What kinds of partnerships would you form? Where is it that you need to touch?
So there's a variety of different partnerships which would benefit our kids. A key area which I would recommend is trying to find partners that create this kind of web of support for our students. Another area, given the service requirements, is to find organizations that provide kids kind of opportunities that Amanda and Bonnie were talking about. There are also organizations that can provide, or individuals that can provide additional services. We have volunteer agencies that are providing tutoring services to our kids.
So I'm going to cover for a second. So how would you partner with the Arizona team to find, like, how would this be tied? How would it be tied to Arizona?
How would we tie to Arizona?
Yeah.
I would say they could rely on the track record and the experience of all five of our existing schools as to what methodologies have worked, who to approach, how to approach them, where we've been able to find support that they might not have looked at. And it would be an advisory capacity.
And just to shift to the board, I'm thinking of, you know, by the way, as 30-10, 30-40, that's your experience, right? So but for the board member,
sure.
So what kinds of, you've been around a long time in this area.
Oh, geez, thanks a lot. Thank you.
You're rich and rich with experience, mature, and what do you think, what would be the key strategic partnerships for the school?
Well,
this could be for driving instructional program, it could be for fundraising.
Absolutely. We have here in the Tucson, in the Phoenix proper, there's a sleuth of opportunities for that. Maricopa Community College System, for example, has a ton of campuses and resources available to support some of the work that we just talked about here a few minutes ago. Arizona State University is just down the street as well. So there are a number of higher education institutions that we can tap into. In addition to that, there are a variety of other groups, Chicanos por la Casa, for example, La Raza, organizations such as that also lend itself really well to support some of the work. A unique opportunity where the school will sit is the Wilson K-12 school system, that we can create opportunities for kids to support some of the work in the lower years with students of that school system. In fact, it's just across the street from where our campus was set. So those are the types of things that we're looking at. In addition to that, part of what we have to recognize is when kids arrive to us, we'll be able to identify the demographic needs, whether it's the refugee population, for example. So there are some unique opportunities there, and there are programs in the Phoenix proper to address those specific needs. The ELL component, and remember, ELL component doesn't just mean Spanish. There's some school systems that have upwards to 100 languages that they're undertaking. So those are the opportunities that we have to tap into within the reach of those groups that are, they exist based on the demographic that we'll be serving, for example.
Could you say more about the Wilson K-12 school system? How do you see partnering there? I'm not sure I caught exactly how.
Well, to me, it's
in some of those partnerships between charter schools and school districts can be challenging.
Absolutely, but the way we see it is because in that general area, there's not a high school.
Right.
Probably within a 10-mile radius a 5-mile radius of the school, there's not a high school. But the opportunity to provide some mentorship to kids in the elementary school, or be readers to kids in elementary school, to participate as special functions of the 7-8 groups, whether it's participating in unique after-school activities, extracurricular activities, or under the supervision of both the high school and, of course, the Wilson school system, we can provide those opportunities for our kids and the Wilson kids. That's what I mean by that.
If I could just jump on that too, one of the things, I'll never forget it, was I had an opportunity to partner with a very active volunteer. He's since passed away, but he was with the Scottsdale Chamber of Commerce, and he was also very active in the Scottsdale School District. And I remember him saying to me, Yvonne, partnerships take into account all kinds of interests, because I was really concerned about, because I think there was a sort of a hostile relationship for a long time between traditional districts and charter schools. And I had worked in traditional districts initially, and so I was very fortunate to bring that experience into the charter environment. And I found that the more I could talk and get people to understand, you know, this is just a public school of choice. We're really all doing the same work. We're working with kids. We're doing it a little bit differently. How can we help each other? And so a lot of the things that we were able to do, I mean, to respond to your question that you asked of David, I mean, one of the things that I didn't have available to me as a brand new charter administrator years ago, I didn't have the infrastructure, you know. When we sat down and wrote that, the grant, you know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I mean, we got it, I think we were fortunate. I really didn't know what I was doing. It would have been infinitely helpful to have been able to pick up the phone and say, David, we've identified something based on the needs of our kids. Can you help us with that? And we didn't have that. So what we started to do really was just bang on doors, pound the pavement. We would go, we pounded the pavement. And so, I mean, we just jotted down. I was just thinking about some of the people who helped us for free. But it was free, but boy, it elevated those kids. We had, you know, when we had United Blood Services, bringing them over and having the kids, you know, aligning that to state standards. Remember, we had the kids teach about, you know, bloodborne pathogens and all kinds of things. But then they were actually the volunteers that were going out and, you know, they ran the blood drive. Junior achievement. We started to teach our kids, you know, it's not just about businesses coming in to help you. What are you going to do for them? Just to give you a very quick little example. So there's the Latino Arts Cultural Center. I'm butchering the name, but it's downtown Phoenix. So one of the things that we could do, we would say to them, all right, so if you can help us, you know, Cesar Chavez Day or whatever, then our students, how about we line up our social studies standards, and then the students can become volunteers for you and act as docents or curators in the museum. So really meaningful stuff. When we get a citizenship fair, you know, we may have had students who couldn't vote or couldn't work, but you know, they could speak Spanish, some of them, right? And so we could bring them in and have them actually provide translation services. You know, so really trying to embed that rigor, relevance, relationships thread through everything. But some of the other people, having the partnerships with Maricopa Community College District, or ASU's teacher prep program, Grand Canyon University's teacher preparation program, you know, maybe getting some of those teachers to come in and do some tutoring, you know, helping us on a Friday with our remediation or our enrichment opportunities, you know, creating job shadowing opportunities for kids, creating internships. I mean, all of that it doesn't cost anything other than the actual effort of going out and making those connections and forming the relationships. But I think for the more significant funding opportunities, you know, having someone who can maybe help us identify those once you know what our needs are, I think that's where we do.
If I could also add just the following. As a board member, and it's really hard for me to separate from the academic conversation, but as a board member, I need to, because they're the hired experts on this. despite my background. But to me, and what I look forward to in this opportunity with those partnerships for our students, and whether we want to call it service opportunities,
sure.
But that there are also meaningful experiences that are gateway for careers or college opportunities. So, for example, working at the Arts Center, mm-hmm. that inspires kids in some capacity to seek college opportunities that steer them in that direction. It doesn't have to be fine arts, it could be in the business aspect of it, it could be a multiple types of opportunities for them. The other part I wanted to mention is one of the roles that the board will undertake is serving in various committees, and one of the committees will be a fundraising committee. That we will, alongside our administrators and the network, also walk hand in hand and approach potential donors of what that means. Now, some of it might be financial donations, but some of it might be in-kind services, like we've been talking about. So there are a lot of opportunities in order to do that. And I have full confidence in our principal, in the network, to help provide some of that support that's worked other places. Because one of the things that I saw when I visited the Las Cruces campus was that I saw those opportunities that the principal was talking about. The kids go on to the community college and do things there, or to other service-oriented types of activities within the Las Cruces city.
And just one additional point, when Alberto was talking about some of the community organizations that serve the refugee populations, to take a step back and talk about what kind of partnerships we want to form, community organizations are often our biggest ally when it comes to outreach amongst the community to recruit students. We have one campus that serves about 20% refugees, and so most of those refugees were first alerted to our schools through the community organizations that we have formed partnerships with. So we need to take a broader picture of how we can work with partners.
just one more thought, if I can. The biggest partners are going to be the parents, and how we engage them in the opportunity to be involved directly with their children. But again, going back to my Las Cruces visit, I had an opportunity to attend a board meeting of that school. And literally, I was in tears of what I saw. Where the stories the children were sharing, they went up and received their Student of the Month award. And the things they were talking about in reference to their experiences and how the school has supported their, not just their academic needs, but their overall needs as an individual, to help them build that self-determination to be a good student, to be goal-oriented, and have achievable goals that are right in front of them. And for them to talk about that to me was really, really profound about this model, and that's why I support this model, otherwise I wouldn't be here, of course. But the big part of it too was when they talked about their parents. And the New Mexico model is very unique that 21 and up can still get their degree, their diploma from the high school. That there was a child and the mother in the same room that mom just had received her graduation diploma from the previous year. That was just so powerful. And those are the types of safety nets that the school system builds just naturally through its existence and its philosophy, that it empowers kids and parents to be fully engaged in their own education, understanding that, yeah, I've got to come to school every day, and if I can't, I'll make it up on Friday or come in the evening. So there's opportunities within that model to support that.
Right.
So I'm sorry, but why isn't this happening in traditional schools?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. Yeah, there's a variety of reasons for that. Part of it is what I would classify as the minutiae of education.
Okay.
There's a ton of things going on in a public school. The volume of kids, and whether you're in a large urban school district or even a small rural school district, you have different challenges. In a small rural school district, you have less opportunities for partnerships because there's less organizations that exist there. And people, at the end of the day, drive miles to go home, as opposed to in an urban setting where there may be more opportunities. But again, even in large urban settings, because of the volume of work, and I do believe that somewhere along the line, when we stop funding public schools at the level they should be funded, we also stop funding those wraparound services at the level we should. So they don't exist at the level that are needed right now. So that creates a lot of issues that we just can't do that holistically. But the mission of this school really emphasizes that component of building the safety nets within the system.
Well, you mentioned a number of things, but it sounds to me ultimately the same focus, right? I mean, in a way, because you're getting, your funding isn't going to be integrated, right? So you'll still have funding challenges. You're going to be located in the landscape where I know our traditional schools in that same urban landscape. So is it more the focus, more the will to do it, or having the eye in the wrong place, or?
Absolutely. Because yeah. What you talked about, when you talked about the children and how you feel about that, you have to, you know, that old adage that you can't love your children to learn.
Right.
But I think you can if you do it the right way. You just don't, you know, pat them on the back for the slightest of things. You really emphasize the rigor. And what I saw on that campus was active engagement from both the teacher and the child. And that was prominent throughout the day, the whole day that I was there, that teachers were teaching in small group, individualized and whole group throughout that session to support the needs of that kid. So that creates that self-determination again that's so much needed. And that's kind of a cause, if you will, that exists as not maybe the primary goal, but something that happens naturally through this process because of the quality of people that are involved in the program.
Could I just jump on that real quick? Because I thought your question was really important when you asked, is it focus? Because I think it is, but I think that really as educators, there should be a really broad collective shift and a reminder that education is a service. Now, I think that the charter school movement as a movement gets that, but I think that somehow, as a whole system, we kind of lost sight of it a little bit. So if we really are a service, and it begins with considering our parents, who we work for, you know, they don't feel very often empowered to come into the school. They feel a little bit intimidated by it. You know, that's why we have organizations, I think, like Expect More Arizona and STEM for Children. But, you know, how do you begin to have that conversation with parents about teaching and learning and what it really means and what it should look like? And so one of the things, I always start with this, where does parent involvement begin? And I know this as a parent because I've had this conversation with my daughter. You know, what did you do at school today? The response is always nothing, right? And so I tell parents, if that's the response, I want you to call me, okay? And I've had a phone call, but they said they did nothing. Because I'm like, well, I meant it. Because we need to change that conversation. And so one of the things that we did, and I thought was great success, was when we went for student-led conferences. And so these became truly exhibitions of learning, where, you know, instead of your traditional parent-teacher conference where you're sitting there and you're doing all the talking to the parent, meanwhile the student's not even there. You know, how do you empower kids to sit down and go, Mom, Dad, so this is, you know, here's a state standard, and here's how I mastered this, here's how I measured when I was doing the Habitat for Humanity thing, here's how I did my service learning. And they're so, and you talk about crying, I mean, to actually walk as the principal through a great big room and hear all these conversations going on, where the conversation is about learning and teaching, where the teachers are truly the facilitators of it and able to come in and intervene when they need to and go, no, let me explain, you know, what's happening. And really putting the student, especially high school students, in charge of their learning, and then also helping parents understand, you know what, you are so much more than being the person who's going to go out and sell wrapping paper, you know, or bring donuts to us. No, we want you here because we want your wisdom. You send us the best kids you have. You are your child's first teacher, and we take that seriously, so let's have a conversation. And this isn't just, I mean, I feel so strongly about this, that in an environment like this, kids thrive because they are known, they know that they're being held to a high standard, they know that we don't feel sorry for them necessarily, that's not what it is. It's how can we help you to be consumers of this thing we're selling you, this education, and remembering that it is a service which impinges on virtually every aspect of life. And I think that we, you know, we have a very short period of time to do that and to change that focus that you said. And anyway, a few questions.
Shifting focus quite a bit. So part of our process is doing a due diligence process on any associated school. So we did look into the performance of the New America schools in Colorado and New Mexico. And it was a little concerning to see that some of the ELA and math proficiency scores are quite low. The Lakewood campus is your strongest campus, but the other four campuses have some pretty dismal scores. So I'm wondering how you would characterize that and that level of proficiency, where it is in comparison to what your growth is in the last several years, and then how you can tell us that that's going to impact Arizona if you're bringing a school that doesn't have a track record of very high proficiency to Arizona, or will it be different and how so?
Okay, perhaps I can start. In Colorado, and I know that Arizona has now adopted virtually verbatim the Colorado model for identifying high-risk students, and I'm not that familiar whether that has caused a ripple effect in terms of the accountability framework. I know that you're off the A to F grade, but it's complicated and it requires some tutoring in terms of what the intricacies of that are. But I can speak very clearly to what the Colorado model is, and the government and the Colorado Department of Education has realized that the accountability framework for students like us needs to have a revisit. And we were very instrumental in getting legislators to look at it, because we felt that in the last 4 or 5 years, some of the measures and how they were treated and how they were reported was unfair to the kind of schools that we support in Colorado. So, truth be told, a work group has been established. They're coming out with recommendations at the end of the month. And just to give you one example on how that will change the kind of metrics and the kind of measures, Tracy, that you just described right now. Right now, they have a growth target for how well did your kids do on math testing? And then how well did your kids do on state testing? And we might have 25 kids that will take the state test, 250 kids that will take the MAP test, and then they'll determine growth. The way Colorado has been doing it is that they gave an equal weighting to both of those. So if that particular section of your report was worth 30%, 15% would go on how well your 20 kids did, and 15% would be on how well the 250 kids did. One of the things that the Colorado Department of Education is now enacting, will be recommending to the commissioner, is that they be weighted according to the number of students. That alone would change our status for all three schools. Another thing that they've done is they've said, and this is a subtle difference in mathematics between a percent and a percentile. And I'm not making excuses here. They're not the greatest results, but they're not truly reflective of the kids that we serve and the kind of achievement that they've done. So they have a three cutoff. They have a 40th percentile, a 60th percentile, and a 90th percentile. So if you are between the 40th and the 60th, you are in the either approaching, meets, and then exceeds. So depending on what range you are in. Well, they're looking at our kids that take the MAP test and let's say get 56%. That's a percent, it's not a percentile. What they have not done is normed that performance with other schools to say at what percentile are you in, because that could conceivably move you to the meets or even exceeds. So the example that I gave the legislators, and they understood this, was that if you had a baseball player that was batting every time, he goes to the plate three times and gets one hit, he's batting 33%. However, that guy would be on the 98th percentile in terms of batting among all the other peers in that particular group. So they're looking at adjusting that. So we're hoping that when they norm those results, and you can easily norm those results through the NWA national norms for MAP, you might find that the 56% or the ones that are in the non-approaching or approaching or meets or does not meet category would jump significantly, because all of a sudden a 56% percent now might translate to the 80th percentile nationally. So those are the kinds of things that they're looking at. So they are retweaking the framework. Now, Are our results great? Absolutely not when you compare them to a traditional school. Our kids come to us at working at a grade 4 or 5 level. They'll take a test in March, 6 months after they enter school. And will they be at grade proficiency? If they were, it would be a miracle. We're not miracle workers. We do the best we can with the population that we serve. They'll come to us, but they will grow. They might grow a year and a half, 2 years. And that's the kind of growth measure that we're starting to look at. And we're starting to say, you know what? Even though some of those results don't look good on paper, but look at this. We have NWEA each year do what's called the virtual comparison group of all our kids. These are not schools that look like us. These are kids that look like us. So if Alan is one of my students in the school, he will be compared to 51 other kids across the country based on certain demographics. How old he is, whether he's on free and reduced lunch, what his starting score was on a particular math test or language arts test. They will do that for him. They'll do that for everybody in the school. And then they'll do a comparison. And they'll say to you, New America School students, when compared to students that look like them, have outperformed them by a significant amount. And our scores typically are at around 150 to 180% of what the national norms are. So are our kids blowing the doors off of a grade 9 or grade 10 standardized test? Absolutely not. But when you compare how they have grown in the school over a period of time, from the spring to the from the fall to the springtime, then there is a significant growth.
Can you frame this? I'm going to frame it a little bit differently because there, I mean, there are growth factors that are taken into consideration in the algorithm they use, right?
But it's so, but they're not normed. They have different cutoff points.
So are they just not normed? Forgive me for not. Are they not normed just for charter schools or not? This is the general way that all scores are treated, right?
They are not normed for students that look like us that are in schools that look like us.
What? Because they take a different test.
They'll compare them, like in Colorado.
Because the way that I see this often in the states, when looking at charter school versus traditional schools, they look at factors that are more commonly occurring among charter school students, such as, expectation of becoming lower, so you don't use absolute scores, for example, or poverty. But I'm not really clear on, I don't really understand. I understand you're saying they're different, right, and they're not norming them. But I just don't want to, I'm not sure I understand how it's an apples to oranges comparison, because how are those students meaningfully different from the students who might be at a traditional school? Do you have a different choice of what exams to take at a charter school? You don't, right?
But in a traditional school, their norm against an entire population of the state, mm-hmm. how they did on their growth in math or on the standardized test. We're compared to 82 schools. We have 82 alternative education campuses in Colorado that they're comparing. So they're comparing our attendance to a school for the incarcerated kids, a school for the blind, a school for the deaf. When we look at our kids, we'll have 70-75% attendance. Is that great? You know what? When you look at other schools that are getting 99-100% because they are spaghetti schools or facility schools where
right.
they're incarcerated? No, they're not.
But then you
talk to the student and you say, how come you're not attending? And they'll say, right. What do you mean I'm not attending? I never went last year to class. This year I'm going 3 days out of every 4. That's fantastic. So it's the comparison of growth on certain measures that we can't get a fix on in terms of how they have done in the past compare them how they are doing today.
I guess part of this is my ignorance, but so just to be clear, absolutely crystal clear, so there are norming is going on in either case, but with traditional schools, they're normed against the pool, which they're normed
much
with,
larger.
Is the pool of all traditional schools or all schools within the state,
all,
including other schools?
They take out the alternative schools.
They take out the alternative schools, and you're considered an alternative school for the purpose of norming your results?
In Colorado, we were.
In Colorado, you were. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. That seems odd to me. I'm sure
they give you an opportunity to introduce a few additional measures and metrics that they would not normally do for
mm-hmm.
a traditional school.
Right.
So, for example, we can introduce how our kids have done behavior-wise.
Sure.
Like most of our kids were a lot of the kids were suspended, expelled, then all of a sudden they come to our school, and because of some of the restorative justice programs and discovery programs that we have in the school, the suspension expulsion rate has catapulted all the way down to less than 5%. That's something that they'll give you credit for. So there's certain things that they tell you that they give you credit for, but oftentimes, because the numbers aren't big enough, they can't determine a norm for that particular measure which you've introduced.
So if I were shopping around for a service provider, and one thing I would want to see would be data that made sense, that translated across the state boundary, or something that was comparable. And it sounds like what you're saying, that the data we see from the Colorado schools is not comparable, so we can't make a fair comparison. I'm just wondering, for folks who are in Arizona, how do you make a judgment about the performance if the performance data you're seeing is unfair in a way to those schools? You're going on the program you're seeing, and I don't know, I'm just asking.
The
question is really, have you done your own assessment? Have you done your own, have you washed it out?
What we have, in addition to the school performance framework, which is mandated by the state, our governing council in Colorado has said, tell us why our schools are successful. So we have come up with additional measures to look at that. One of them being, for example, credit accrual.
Right.
And we say, how many credits are our kids getting in the year? We have the board set some targets that X percent of the students obtain 4 or more credits, Y percent of the kids get 5 or more credits. So we're measured against that, but we can't report that back to the state because that particular measure isn't included in their school performance framework. Graduation rate is another one. So typically a 4-year graduation rate says how many kids did you start in grade 9, how many kids have graduated at the end of grade 12. If you started with 100 kids, 60 of them graduate, you get a 60%. Well, when kids come to your school with interrupted education, they're already a 0 in the numerator and a 1 in the denominator because they can't graduate on time. So one of the things that we've presented to our governing council in Colorado is, let's look at a cohort of kids. Let's see how many of them are within 5 credits of graduation in that school year. Now let's determine how many of them, in fact, graduate in that year. We have 64-65% of those kids. Now, that number would be considerably lower if we had to apply the strict definition of, you know, the numerator in 4-year time, when they graduated within a 4-year period.
So, you know, and of course, I'm not suggesting that you should focus on tests above actual thinking, but there may be things that are more important to you, right, and to other folks, that in terms of being held accountable for performance in this state. So what kind of an exercise do you do to make sure that, I know the things you're talking about make sense, certainly. Are there the things that Arizona's contract, that Arizona's expectations will also account for,
I think for me, obviously I can't really speak to this without bringing in the context of my own personal experience, okay? So for me, when you say, is it the model, is it the program? I think if I look at my own track record as a principal who turned around schools that had, frankly, appalling scores, both at Gateway and Florence Quinton, And so basically, I think one of the things that I did, of course, I was going into a situation where I had to turn it around, I wasn't starting from scratch, but you know, if you have a problem where no one's passing, no one's showing up, how do you fix that? Right? So, you know, you look at the research and you start to put the systems and structures in place that will support learning. And so I think because of my familiarity with the model, and I know what I saw when I went there, and I know that I can speak to that model and its success based on my own personal experience with it, you know, with the LaGuardia model, for example, which is what this school is based on too. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but one thing that I would say is that I'm not an excuses person, you know. It's not going to be, you know, you're going to show up to us because I believe that you can learn. Now, you might start way down here. I want to be able to look at a parent and say to that parent or that student, let me show you what we're going to do using this model here, and let me show you some examples of individual students. Because I think that's how you connect with parents and kids who have taken advantage of this model, teachers who can implement it really well, and then how is that going to change the trajectory of your life? I mean, I can go from big vision, which a lot of, I think, this can be, but then you also have to be very granular and urgent at the same time. And so for me, it's the strength of the model. And it's difficult for me to talk about it without referring to my own experience with it here in Arizona.
Just to clarify, if I may, one of the things that we did intentionally was not apply as an alternative school.
Right.
We did not do that. That has all sorts of negative connotations. We haven't got a clue who was going to be coming to our school. We could potentially have an early college program in place. I just want to say that what I spoke about in terms of an alternative model is something that is occurring in Colorado. It's very different in New Mexico. And we're starting with the highest expectation for our kids. And it's our expectation, as you looked at the numbers, when we compared to some of the benchmark schools, we think we can do better.
And just to clarify a little bit, the big picture of those statistics. Lillian Ellen, you asked, well, what's the difference if you are being judged as either a traditional school or there as an alternative school? In Colorado, the school performance framework, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, has certain standards for traditional schools. Then there's also a school performance framework that's adopted for alternative education campuses, which are what those statistics are. But what the state has recognized right now is that the alternative framework that you have in your hands is actually very, very similar to the traditional framework. And the process that they're going through, it should be ending within a month or two, is going to be revising that framework that you have in your hand so that it is better able to evaluate the actual performance of alternative schools. And what Dominic is presenting is that once that framework is revised to actually not be a so-called alternative framework, that's really a traditional framework, that we'd be able to show you that the results are much different, and we could provide you the data that says this is what it's going to show.
I understand. Very good. So, traditionally, board members would hold service providers responsible for performing under a contract. So, what are your thoughts about holding performance to a level where?
Absolutely. Well, let me put it in this context. I spent the better part of my 30 years working in really underserved communities, high-need areas, places where people don't want to go work. It's easier and softer to work in a place that's more affluent and things just roll right along and you're in the old system, you're in A school and everyone applauds you. But if you're in an underserved community where it's really challenging and you're a D or an F school, but you're still making some progress and maybe the measurement doesn't exactly show that, but you have to be there to experience that. And I believe that the principal matters the most, the most influential part of that system. But I believe the teacher is the most important. That direct instruction has to be top-notch. We've already heard from our principal, and hopefully you sense her passion about what she does and what she wants to accomplish on this campus and at this school. I am confident that we're going to find the right teachers, and we have one here in the room today, that will fit the need of what we're addressing here. Not only do they have to have the expertise, but they have the commitment, the passion to work and teach underserved communities and students. And that's what it's all about to me. So absolutely, we are going to hold our principal and our teachers to a high level of accountability. We're going to get monthly reports on where we are with academic progress, with attendance, amongst other factors in the school. But that's what as a board member, I expect high academic achievement results. I expect that growth. So the high academic achievement results come in a variety of measures. It can be a standardized test, it can be a formative assessment, it can be a variety of other variables that we use. But I want to be involved in that part of it directly. And then we make critical decisions at the end of the year as based on those, whether it's a teacher hire or a principal hire for that matter.
Yeah. time for questions. You do have 5 more minutes to get with any closing statements, anything else that you want covered before we end our time.
I think we should give Craig an opportunity, otherwise he's alone here from Denver. To say.
The floor is
yours. Saving him with the hammers.
Thanks, Tom. I could have done without that. I'm very, very happy. Our role, and my role, is to make sure that we have the right facilities for these kids. And we've been working for some months now to obtain that facility. We do very stringent demographic reviews before we even select the area. We work very closely with the board members and the principal about where should this school be? Where are the kids that we need to serve with? And Bob said, you can't go west of here, you can't go east of here, you can't go north of there, you can't go south of here. I want it there. We have a wonderful location at 3224 Fillmore. It is the community that we serve. It's an at-risk community. Heavily immigrant English language learners and academically underserved kids. In fact, there was a former high school there at one time, the Victor Romero High School, that was closed. I did research in that school, and I was advised that you say, well, why will you get your enrollment numbers? Well, there were 400 kids in that school at one time, because the closest school was Hamilton. And you have to go under freeways and everything to get up there. There's one further south, South Mountain. But we were very careful to make sure that we put our schools in the communities that need to be served. And this, and you can see from the research that you've done, this is a community that needs to be served. And that, the Rossi Development Corporation is our senior lender. They've already signed on for about $4 million senior loan. Another Charter Development Corporation has signed on to that position. We are ready to go. I've got a letter of intent in that's been accepted for the property. Of course, I have my due diligence period. It doesn't end until the end of December, so it's lost. Things don't work out. But I hope they work out because we're ready to put a school in this community that they will be proud of. The kids will, you know, they, we found in our other communities where we built these types of schools, they've been, I hate to use the word disrespected in some ways, in a lot of ways. And so we put a very respectful environment there so they can do their job. The other thing that I will ensure is adhering to the standards of financial policies and procedures integrated with Arizona's financial policies and procedures. There will be a local board record business manager that's open hire. I will act as a CFO more or less to oversight that. And work in conjunction with that. So the principal can focus on the educational mission of the school and the wraparound needs of these students. So, I don't know.
You should be bragging some more, because in every one of the 5 schools, there's close to $750,000 fund balance that remains. And that is probably quite atypical of charter schools anywhere that I've looked at. So the financial management is done in spades.
But I might say, 30, 10, 30, 40, 50.
Yeah. He's much better looking than I am.
I don't want to hear from you. 70 or something.
That goes back down.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, to conclude the in-person interview, I will describe the next steps for you. The technical review panel will evaluate the scores from the review of your written application package as well as the findings of the interview panel here today. This will include whether or not your written application package meets the scoring criteria specified in the application and whether the interview panel finds sufficient capacity to operate a charter school. Following that, a recommendation report will be submitted to board staff and presented to the board at the December 14th, 2015 meeting. It's a full day meeting. It's slated to begin at 9 a.m. And so that you are aware, the recommendation report will be available 2 weeks in advance. It'll be posted with our board meeting agenda materials on the website. And if you have any questions between now and then, I will be your contact person. I'll leave each of you with my card. And once again, the State Board for Charter Schools would like to thank you for coming in today and for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children in Arizona.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.